I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's June 29th, and welcome to the 200th episode of Real Talk MS. I have to admit that it's still hard for me to wrap my head around that number. I remember recording the very first episode of the podcast, thinking it would be awesome if I could work my way up to having a few hundred listeners. The goal I set for myself was getting to 300 listeners. And so here we are. 200 episodes of Real Talk MS, plus a few bonus episodes, have been downloaded more than 1 million times by thousands of listeners in over 100 countries around the world. And it's beyond humbling for me to be a part of this weekly conversation with you. So I'd like to propose a virtual toast to say thank you to each one of you in the Real Talk MS listener community. To those of you who have been especially encouraging, like Diane MacArthur, Dan and Jennifer Digman, Jenna Green, Cliff Curry, Carol Ann Murphy, and Siani Sumlin. To my friends Sarah, Holly, Lindsay, David, and Robert at iConquer MS, who were some of the first folks to reach out to support Real Talk MS. And to everyone at the National MS Society, especially Elizabeth Doherty, Ron Zwerin, Bruce Bebo, Barry Talenti, Tim Cutsey, and Cindy Zaghi-Boilo. Each of you make it incredibly easy for me to do this. So cheers! And thank you. When I saw that episode 200 was coming up, I thought about who might join me as my guest, and it occurred to me that in conducting more than 200 interviews, I still hadn't had an opportunity to sit down for a full interview with Cindy Zaghi-Boilo, the president and CEO of the National MS Society. Since the National MS Society is the largest private funder of MS research in the world, the driving force behind all of the MS advocacy that takes place here in the United States, and the very first place that I turned to when my wife Jean received her MS diagnosis, I thought it made a lot of sense to invite Cindy to acknowledge the National MS Society's 75 years of progress and talk about some of the initiatives that the MS Society is involved in today. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, President and CEO of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, Cindy Zaghi-Boilo. True story, when I first launched Real Talk MS, I launched a companion website at realtalkms.com, and one of the things that you can actually still do at the website is sign up to receive email updates about each podcast episode. The very first person to sign up to receive those email updates is my guest today. It's truly my pleasure to welcome the very first member of the Real Talk MS listener community, the president and CEO of the National MS Society, Cindy Zaghi-Boilo. Welcome to the podcast, Cindy.
Oh, thank you. And I didn't know I was the first. I'm just so thrilled to hear that. And as you know, I've been an admirer of you from day one.
Well, from day one, I can't tell you how that just inspired and motivated me to see that email come through. So I appreciate you from day one as well. You became president and CEO of the National MS Society in 2011. I think at that point, there were only about a half dozen approved disease-modifying therapies. Now we have more than 20. In 2011, the International Progressive MS Alliance didn't exist. And today, it's not only an amazing example of global scientific collaboration, but it's proven to be a significant force in focusing the research agenda when it comes to progressive MS. And in 2011, no one was talking about pathways to cures for MS like we are today. So lots of changes, really important changes, have taken place during your tenure as president and CEO of the society. I'm wondering whether there have been any surprises.
Well, you just had a great summary of all the fabulous things that have happened, a lot of the fabulous things that happened most recently. What always continues to be surprising to me is the resilience of people affected by MS and of the MS movement. It just never ceases to amaze me. The power of putting a big problem in front of the right people and the teamwork that results and the persistence in working together to figure things out. That's what we did in establishing the Alliance, as you said. And it's also what we did to develop a nationwide case management service so that people affected by MS could get a supportive partner in, when they had the most challenging circumstances in their lives. And most recently, in clarifying, as you said, pathways to MS cures, that's what you do. You just put a big problem in front of a group of the right people and they sort it out. I find that to be miraculous.
I couldn't agree more. And now if we can go from where we are today back a little ways, Sylvia Lowry founded the society 75 years ago. I know you had an opportunity to actually work with Sylvia Lowry. But in 1946, when she founded the MS Society, the idea of a woman leading an organization was almost unheard of. Because you did know Sylvia, I wonder, what do you suppose her mindset was then, and what would she have to say today?
Well, Ms. Lowry was single-minded. There's just, I think that's the best way to describe her. She was devoted to finding answers, first of all, for her brother, Bernard, who had MS, and then for the greater good for people who have MS in general around the world. She was incredibly bold, fortified in her passion, and she was fearless and fully expectant that she would be taken seriously. That's what it seemed like when you saw her. She just did not shrink, did not shy away from any conversation. She was highly persistent and very organized in her approach and seemed unfazed by the societal limits put on her, put on women, put on her gender. She just, it didn't seem to be a part of who she was. She was incredibly inspiring in that way. And of course, I knew her as an older woman. So perhaps as a younger woman, it was somewhat different, but I don't think so. I think that was just who she was, just absolutely with great conviction. And I think today she would be proud of the progress and that her approach continues to help us make progress, bringing people together to find solutions from everywhere in the world, asking boldly, just having that general assumption that, of course, people want to help and give what they can. I think she'd be proud of us.
Well, you just mentioned that Sylvia Lowry's vision was not merely local, it was global. And I don't know that all of my listeners know that 21 years after founding the National MS Society, Sylvia Lowry also founded the MS International Federation. That was in 1967, when the concept of global collaboration hadn't really begun to take hold anywhere. What do you suppose she was thinking when she launched the MSIF?
I think she wanted to bring more people into the movement. She just knew that the more people she had, the more we could focus on finding answers. And she already had international connections. She really started out that way because in funding research, from her viewpoint, the National MS Society started out funding internationally. She just never saw boundaries and never limited the research funding that we did at the society. She didn't limit it to the United States. So she had connections and she knew there were smart, passionate people all over the world. And it's best to have them focused on the thing she was trying to solve, MS. So that was, I think, a big part of her thinking. And she established the MS International Federation first in New York City. That was convenient. She had control over that. That's where she lived. And she launched it there. And then once there was momentum and she was bringing it forward, she moved it to London so that it had a more of an international feel and presence and was more accessible to bigger parts of the world. So really an incredible feat and great, great vision.
Moving from some of the history of the society into where we are today, research is emerging that shows that multiple sclerosis impacts Black people differently, often with a more severe disease course. But members of minority communities are typically underrepresented in MS research. How do we ensure greater diversity in clinical trials? And is there a role here for the MS Society to play?
Yeah, it is a problem. And we need to better understand the barriers to research participation. We need to understand those more clearly and not assume that we understand them fully. And then we need to pave the way for more involvement. There's a lot of energy around this from lots of different places now, and we need to really leverage that and make the most progress. We know that it's important. Research results can't be translated necessarily from men to women or from white to Black. We need to have diverse clinical trials, and everyone needs, so it's important for everyone to be involved. I think the most important thing that we can do at the Society is to build the MS movement, to make sure that people find a landing place. If you have MS, if you're affected by MS, you find a home, a feeling of belonging with the National MS Society, and then people can connect to what they need and what they're ready for. You know, letting people know about the opportunities that they have where they can contribute and listening to what they want to contribute enables us to connect people with each other and with those opportunities. I believe people want to be part of solutions. They might not know how, or they might not feel fully safe doing that, but they also need to feel heard and understood. And having a bigger MS movement, a place where people can find out what they need to understand how they can have the biggest effect on what concerns them, I think is the best thing we can do as the National MS Society.
Minority communities are also negatively impacted by systemic inequities in healthcare. And this goes far beyond just research. It includes quality of care and even access to care. So when it comes to MS care, how do we fix that?
Well, it's complex and a broad problem. And I think the National MS Society, we have several roles in correcting the inequities that exist. We need to be clear about the facts, first of all, the facts about MS, what is known about MS in various populations. And some of these facts are emerging. We're learning more. We know that Black people get MS. We know that children get MS. We have to remove any barriers to diagnosis that are based on misinformation. So making sure people know that this is something that can present in all people and they know to look for it. That's important. So education among the medical community, but also people need to know what they can expect and what they deserve in a healthcare setting. If you walk into a doctor's office or a hospital, it's important to feel confident about asking the right questions and feeling safe, again, in a medical setting, having a partnership with medical professionals. And that's one of the things we can do at the Society. We can help people gain that confidence so they can maneuver a healthcare system and at the same time, engage medical professionals and healthcare systems to be more inclusive and culturally aware and able to serve people better. I believe that healthcare professionals, they want to help people. That's why they went into that profession. They don't always have all the tools to be able to do that effectively in the culture. And another thing in MS, John, is the access to MS specialists. It's a big part of the solution. And this is something we are directly and very putting a lot of energy behind. There just aren't enough providers who are expert in MS. You have some of the real experts on this show on a regular basis, but we need more. And so we need to educate general neurologists and increase public awareness in general about MS in order to speed the process of diagnosing and activating a personalized plan so that an individual can get what they need when they're diagnosed, when that diagnosis is confirmed, and then they get on a drug therapy and a lifestyle approach that will ensure that they can live their best life. So there's a lot of components to addressing this need and getting these disparities fixed.
The National MS Society is also a founding member of the International Progressive MS Alliance, and you serve as the chair of the Alliance Executive Committee. Why was it important to create this global focus specifically on progressive MS, and how would you characterize the work that the Alliance has so far accomplished?
We could have a whole conversation about this, John. So the Alliance started fundamentally because there was a huge gap and in some ways an outcry from people with progressive MS. It was a time when there were some effective treatments for relapsing MS, but nothing that was approved for progressive forms of the disease. And imagine yourself, and I know you can imagine yourself as someone affected by progressive MS. As we celebrated each new breakthrough for relapsing remitting MS, people who were diagnosed or who loved somebody who was diagnosed with progressive MS felt left out. And I remember one person sharing with me at one point, "I don't have an MS society for my MS." And that was heartbreaking. And I took it as a real call to action. We needed to do something different. And because it wasn't for a lack of trying to find therapies for progressive MS, it was just that what we had tried had not worked. So clearly we needed to do something different. We needed to do something different to get a different result. And following again, Sylvia Lowery's approach, that's what we did. We pulled together a smart group of people and we put the problem in the middle of the table, progressive MS, and we asked them to do whatever it took to describe the obstacles in finding progressive MS therapies and to design ways to overcome those obstacles. And so it was a process. And so once we had the start of the scientific blueprint, we then needed to organize around it, because you need that organizational structure so that you can persist and sustain the efforts. And then we could focus on achieving the progress that people with progressive MS just needed. So that's why we created the Alliance, bringing together the MS societies all over the world who fund MS research, in particular those who had research structures. We started there. And then bringing those scientists together, we brought researchers from industry together. And most importantly, people affected by progressive MS, so that we could make the best decisions and buoy each other, make sure that we had that energy to keep going. And in terms of progress, we built a movement focused on progressive MS. I think that's probably the best way that I would describe it. And there is now a heightened awareness of progressive MS. I've heard from people, I feel like you're with me now. I feel like the MS Society is supporting me too. I get it. I see it. I feel seen. I feel heard. And this increased attention and increased research on progressive MS has demonstrated results. We have the three established international networks focused on identifying drug targets for progressive MS and potential therapies. And the third network is focused on predicting the course of MS using MRI data and artificial intelligence. Really exciting stuff that's going on. And still, we've been able to maintain and continue to grow the partnership and the involvement. 19 MS organizations from around the world are now in membership in the Alliance. And I'm really proud of that and proud of everyone who is part of that movement and part of our progress.
Well, I think most of my listeners know by now that I'm one of those people that was affected by progressive MS. My wife lived with it for 23 years. And I was fortunate enough to be one of those people who was selected to represent families who are affected, or I should say represent the perspective of families who are affected by progressive MS by sitting on the Alliance Scientific Steering Committee. As I'm completing my 6-year term and terming out over the next few months, I've told people over and over again when the subject comes up, this has been, for me personally, some of the most satisfying and remarkable work I've ever had the honor of participating in. I think the Alliance has been remarkable in giving those of us who are affected by progressive MS a reason to recognize that, hey, there is a society for us. There is a movement for us. There is progress being made, and it's being driven by this organization that literally didn't exist 10 years ago. So I'll just add my two cents because that's something that I can speak about as well.
Well, thanks, John. That means the world to me.
Well, last year, the Society convened the Pathways to Cures think tank. And following that meeting, work continued in developing a roadmap that details the pathways to cures for MS. Now, cure is one of those words that gets everyone's attention. So can you tell us what the Pathways to Cures initiative is all about, and maybe explain why cures is used in the plural here?
Yes. Okay. That's a simple question. That's great. It is, and it's really nice to have this question on the heels of the International Progressive MS Alliance question, because I think there's that the formation of the alliance and that work gave us the chutzpah, gave us the kind of the feeling that we can do this too. In fact, when I was recruiting a facilitator for our board retreat, we had a scientific meeting and a board retreat together for the National Board of Directors. I was recruiting someone to facilitate the conversation. And I said, one of the things we need to do is develop pathways to MS cures. This is what we're doing. And this very experienced facilitator who has done facilitation work in other disease-related organizations, science-based, you know, communications, he says, that's not possible. And I told him, I said, well, no, it is, and we will. And we've already made great progress on progressive MS and formed this. I told him all about the alliance. And he said, oh, maybe you really can do it. And so I had no doubt that, you know, again, you get smart people in the room together, focused on something, and you can make big things happen. So establishing the alliance gave us the confidence that we could bring the world even more firmly together on pathways to MS cures. So that think tank you mentioned was a milestone in our work. It wasn't the beginning. We had begun probably about 18 months earlier than that, you know, getting the science organized and together in our work. And you see our fiscal year 2019 to 2021 strategic plan that we're just wrapping up now. One of our definitions of success was to build international consensus on pathways to cures. That's what we defined it back in 2019. And there were some people who thought that was pretty far out there to do that. But we were determined from the beginning to do that work. And so the think tank brought together teams of researchers to review an early draft of the Pathways to Cures playbook, which had been in the works. And I don't know if your listeners know this, John, maybe in some ways that at the National MS Society, we have a team of really smart researchers who are on staff, and they are very well versed in what's going on throughout the world in various parts of MS research. They, of course, do manage our grant funding process, but they're also responsible for influencing the decisions that are made by other people who fund MS research in ways that are supportive and collaborative. And so they really carry a lot of weight. And so they had done a tremendous amount of work to lead the development of the playbook. And so we identified what is needed, what discoveries are needed, what are the obstacles in the way of the work that is needed to stop MS, which essentially means keep it from progressing. So that's one cure. What's needed to restore lost function, getting remyelination going, getting people to recover from symptoms that they have. And that's another type of cure. And then also to end MS, which we define as being no new cases of this disease. And that's why we refer to cures in the plural. And there are intersections to all these pathways. So there are things we need to learn that forward all of these different pathways. But by having the clear path forward in each one of those cures, stop, restore, and end, gives us a roadmap that everyone can follow. I mean, just as the experience of living with MS is different for every person's cure for MS may look different. And we know this because we ask people, to tell us, what does a cure mean to you? And we heard all these different ways. It means I won't get any worse, or it means I'm going to be able to get back to doing some of those things I loved doing, or it means I don't ever want to have to worry about my child or my grandchild being diagnosed with MS. So we're working to find all of those cures as quickly as possible.
Just listening to you now, I'm thinking your career at the National MS Society actually began in 1985. And at that time, there was no internet. There were no disease-modifying therapies. And too often, the standard treatment for MS was, as they say, diagnose and adios. There just wasn't much that doctors could do to help people living with MS. And as we've been discussing, there have been remarkable changes since 1985. But I'm curious, how have you seen the MS community itself, the people affected by MS, how have they changed since 1985?
Well, it's been significant, but there's one thing that has not changed. We still have each other. Pretty much that's all we had back in 1985. We only had each other, and building that movement and gaining and supporting each other was the most important thing we can do. And we still have that. But since then, now what's most powerful is that in general, people are doing better. The therapies and the increased knowledge about the importance of exercise and being fit and being socially connected, those things and understandings have positively affected the course of the disease for many, many people. And you can witness that just by being around. Also, the stigma of having MS is less, and the knowledge and understanding of what it is. We're less confused with other diseases than ever before. And that's powerful. Even big swaths of the general public understand what MS is better, and they have less confusion about what it could be. And there's a greater willingness of people to share their stories about living with MS, which increases community support and helps people be more connected. We've made great progress. At the same time, another thing that's happened, and you talk about this all the time, John, is that there is access to a lot of misinformation. And that is a challenge. And that can make it challenging to trust what you hear and to understand whether it's actionable and something you should do. And so some people who are newly diagnosed are just bombarded with well-meaning friends and family members who are sending things they hear about on social media, and that's not based in science. And so this is something we need to really work against. And I know you're doing your part for sure. There have always been unfounded claims in MS, always. We had a book that we used to, a three-ring binder that we used to go through called Therapeutic Claims in MS. And some of them were valid and some of them were outrageous, but it was the beginning of when we didn't have an internet, it was the beginning of collecting those facts and that scientific and having a scientific review so that we could distribute information. So, you know, we've made great progress, and there's still more to do.
Speaking of which, this year, the National MS Society is celebrating its 75th anniversary, and you're marking a decade as the Society's president and CEO. After 10 years, what excites you most about your job?
I've been in this work for, what, since 1985, what is that, 36 years overall, and you're just letting me know that it's my 10th year as CEO. It's gone by very, very quickly. Every single day, I've always felt that it is an honor to do this work. I'm inspired by the amazing people that I get to meet. I was amazed by that in the very beginning of my career when I was young, that people would take my calls because they cared about MS. And we shared that and wanted to do something about it. And so that is exciting to get to meet so many people and to engage with and learn from people. And the fact that people will share their stories with me, that I find that to be really powerful and exciting. the resilience of people with MS is just often just absolutely incredible. Not everyone has to feel all resilient all the time. I just want to make sure that that's clear, because there are times that each of us feels like, okay, I'm done. I just can't stand this anymore. And that's why we need this wonderful movement that we have. And we need to continue to build this movement. It's a place where people can belong, to feel understood, to vent, to be unhappy at times and to be exuberant at others, to problem solve and to support each other. So that's what I find just so super excited. I get excited whenever anyone finds their voice to express what they're here for, what matters to them, and what they want from life. And when they get to tell their story and what life means to them, I'm just excited for them. And I feel that that's a really important thing that we do with the society. And I'm excited for the future. I am an eternal optimist. Let's just face it. I really am. I believe we can solve things and that we will. And so there's just a lot of excitement now, especially as we can see the pandemic starting to get behind us, and we can see some of excitement for the future. So these are exciting times.
Cindy Zaghi-Boilo, thank you for all that you do to improve the lives of people affected by MS. Thank you for signing up for that weekly email update about the podcast back in September 2017. And thanks for talking with me.
Well, I don't miss an episode, John, and I'll be eager to listen to this one. Take care, and thank you for all you do.
That's going to wrap up episode 200 of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/200. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or text. So thank you once again for your emails, your phone calls, your DMs, and your texts. Thank you for sharing the podcast with your friends and family. And thank you for sharing this journey with me. Without each of you, I'd just be talking to myself. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.